Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And John, this one got a smile on my face. When I saw this book and I said, well, there has to be a large preponderance of the audience that we can consider to be spoken about as a result of the content in this book, which is called Politics is for Power. Now, what does that mean very simply? It means that those of us, and look, I was a talk show host for, 7 years or longer when you look at the weekends, and I was an editorialist trying to do documentaries that would bring light to political issues for many years. But in many ways, even doing all of that, even though I might have been much more engaged, I was a political hobbyist, John, and
really?
I still am.
Okay.
Well, do you know what that means?
It means you follow it, you enjoy it.
Consume it, talk about it,
right.
Rail about it, and do nothing to affect the outcome of it all. Well, no, I mean, I guess I was trying to influence a lot of people. But having said that, most of us who are watching more cable news than we ever should, reading more stuff online and getting angry and commenting on Facebook, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to do, don't get me wrong. Well, maybe it's not a wonderful thing to do. That's what we're going to learn about today on this podcast.
Right.
Eitan Hersh, who is a political science professor at Tufts University, he tells us that in many ways, as much as we think we're in the game, John, because we're following things in ways that others don't, you don't know that? You didn't read that article in The Atlantic? You don't understand that? You didn't read the editorial in The New York Times? And we take pride in that. But we're not on the front lines of politics.
Well, not to mention, I think, especially being isolated, 24-hour news will make you crazy, I've determined. It'll just make you totally nuts.
Well, you know, you really struck on something there, and you don't even know it. Because one of the arguments that Professor Hersh brings to us today is that it's made our politicians crazy. Because they realize that to get your attention, and you're always glued, they've got to say something that is more perhaps outlandish or outrageous or just something that will turn the screws and turn the dial on your interests. So they know that. So they purposely do things. So they make positions that might have been more moderate, more extreme to get our attention. And we're always there taking in this voluminous content all the time. But the question really is, well, who's out there doing the hard work of politics? So if your candidates are always losing, you might want to consider the fact that you're not out there in the trenches doing the phone calling. Doing the hard work of organizing, trying to help a candidate get over the finish line, really to do the hard stuff of politics. Well, I got to ask you, John. I mean, in our town, I mean, I'm on a commission, but it's a nonpartisan commission about blight and such. But I am involved in that. But I don't get that involved at all in the town committee or any
right,
of that
politics.
Work. I mean, that's a lot of intensive work that goes
that is,
on.
That's a hard job, and I appreciate the people who do it, but it's... I mean, you got to take up a lot of your time in order to do that.
Exactly. And sometimes you say, well, gee, I am committed, but really, do I want to do 4 nights a week of phone calling and hearing people on the other end berating me because they disagree? The one time in our town where I really did get involved, John, was when we had this issue about a high school because we had to send our kids, you remember, right, to all right. these other districts. Sean and I live in the same town. And I got involved. I went door to door. And at that time, I was on television a lot, and I was asking for money for public television, as you recall. And somebody looked at me when I came to the door, said, "Oh, no, they're coming directly for the donations now." I said, no, I'm here about the school. And they said, "Well, we disagree with you about that, too." So, well, anyway, politics is for power. How to move beyond political hobbyism, take action, and make real change.
This sounds like a good one.
Oh, it is. Today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Aiken Hirsch. And he's a professor in the Department of Political Science at Tufts University. And he really focuses on civic participation, U.S. elections, voting rights. And he's written a new book that I find fascinating called Politics is for Power. And I'll give you the subtitle in just a moment. But Eitan, I want to talk first on civic participation because you study it here in America, because in the city in which I grew up, which was a very active political city in Connecticut, we used to really have such incredible politics, much of it tainted, but very aggressive and very involved. Had lots of people really on the edge of their seat every election cycle. And you'd see elections that were locally drawn that would get out about 70 to 80% of the voters. Today, that number is closer to 25%. Is that reflective of what's going on across the country?
Yeah, it sure is. You know, we're at a time now where we've had the highest levels of interest in politics. You know, the National Election Studies, it's a big survey done every presidential year since 1952, asks how interested you are in the election. And 2016, highest ever. But you look at numbers like the number of people engaged in organizations, volunteering for a campaign or a party, voting in local elections, and we're well below historical numbers. So we have a lot of interest and time spent on politics, but not in local elections, not in community organizations, not in ways where people are actually individually influencing the government.
How reflective is that as to what's going on in our society? If we go back to the great book Bowling Lone, where people aren't joining various community groups, they're not joining the Elks Club and the Lions Club in the way that they had in the past. Robert Putnam has really been the person bringing all that information to our attention. How much is that reflective of what's going on in our politics?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Bowling Lone, which came out in 2000, showed this massive decline since the kind of post-war era of community and civic engagement. And I think what my book's doing is helping to answer, well, what has replaced all that? Because we have a lot of leisure time, but it's spent really differently. And it's spent on what I call hobbyism, kind of shallow hobbies. Now, there's non-political versions of this. You know, I think there are people who are, you know, foodies, say, who spend a lot of time all at home, reading restaurant reviews, watching videos, watching Food Network. But they'll spend a lot of time on that in 5-minute stints throughout the whole day. And for people who like politics, that's kind of how they spend their political time. In 5-minute stints, they check Facebook, they check Twitter. And by the end of the day, it amounts to 2 or 3 hours, but all in these short, shallow stints.
But when we go back and we look at people who used to be involved, whether they were a Democrat or Republican, they would just get so immersed in the politics. They loved the canvassing. They loved the calling out. It was a social thing. It was an activity that, again, just made them feel part of their community. And you talk about people in your book who do combine the whole idea of community politics. But what has happened to tear that asunder?
Well, a few things. I mean, I talk about these three big trends that have happened. I mean, technology, I think, is the easiest one, which is because it's so easy to feel a little bit connected to other people through social media and feel like you have some stimuli around you, whether it's your TV or a podcast, it makes it feel like a big lift to go in the evening for a meeting. Like, that just feels relatively hard compared to what it used to feel like when that was the only option. So you see people, particularly who aren't engaged in regular communities, like think oh my God, I to show my face in a place. And, that's one of the reasons you see it more on the left than on the right. On the right, folks who are, for example, going to church every week, and then maybe they're also volunteering for a church committee, they are in regular situations where people are counting on them to be there. And if they're not there, they'll get a phone call. Hey, you missed the meeting. Or, we didn't see you on Sunday. If you're not involved in the community like that, no one, as I say in the book, if you leave Facebook, calls you and said, hey, I missed your hot takes. It's just these relationships are not serious enough that we're working on each other for them.
Well, you point to a woman deep into the book, Alicia, from Oxford, Connecticut. And she really combined a lot. She didn't go out just in a march for women's rights. She got involved in a group other than a soror, she said, and it really empowered her, and it allowed her to put her politics about women's issues into play, into action. But she had to go somewhere. She had to do something. It wasn't just being demonstrative online.
That's right, and Alicia's story is really interesting because, as I say in the book, most people who would look at what she's doing wouldn't necessarily see it as political. They would see it as community service. What she does, and a number of other women in colleges across the country really, is this program called Strong Women, Strong Girls, where a bunch of college women go into city, mostly poor minority city schools, and they have a mentorship program for the young women focused on highlighting stories of women of all ages who are doing something, of value, something inspirational. So what's political about what Alicia's doing? First of all, she's teaching girls about feminism, and she sees that as political. She's also a black woman who is mentoring white women in college and helping them interact with communities that are really different from them, helping her white college peers figure out a way to connect to the girls that they're seeing in their school who have such different backgrounds than mostly privileged kids who are in the college campus. And Alicia sees that role as quite political too, because she's working on, really up close racial dynamics, both in the schools and in the college students that she's working with. And so she sees that there is a real direct connection between this form of community service and her political goals.
I want to take a deep dive into your book because it really is fascinating. But before we do that, I've got to ask you, because we hear it all the time, that one of the problems as it relates to civic involvement and engagement is the fact that we're not teaching it in the schools. We don't do enough about American history, about civics. Is that true, or is that just one of these things that we say and comfortably believe?
No, I mean, I think it's true, and I think there's a lot of different approaches, and this is where there's some conflict about how you teach that kind of thing. My colleagues at Tufts at the Tisch College of Civic Life have worked on curriculum designs that, gone through state legislatures to try to influence the way civics is taught. There's obviously history, and there's also participatory engagement, and there's also leadership. I think that there's this phenomenally weird thing that you see a lot of college campuses, college towns, which is that the local people who live in those communities would love to get college students and maybe high school students too on board. They want them to be the foot soldiers for some kind of political activism, and they wonder, why don't the students want to do something like that? Well, the answer is that a lot of those organizations don't really want to empower this, put them in leadership roles, help them craft what they're working on. The groups often want the students to just be kind of quiet foot soldiers doing what they're told, and no one wants to do that. And so part of civics is having students and young people be in leadership roles and giving them that mentorship and not just thinking that they are mindless foot soldiers. That's not going to play well.
Let me give you my case. I've been in the media for many years, and for that reason, I felt that getting involved in politics was not something that I should do because I was covering all kinds of issues on a statewide basis. So I turned it away, but I did volunteer on state commissions, the State Commission on Children, Video and Film Commission. I got involved more recently in my own local community on the Anti-Blight Commission. But any of the real political dirty work, other than organizing around a high school that we needed in our community, I really shunned it. But I was always aware of what was going on. Then I became a talk show host. So I was talking about politics all the time and trying to persuade people, but I didn't really talk about a political affiliation. We would talk issue by issue, and I have different views. So I might be more conservative on certain things, more liberal on others. So the question is, where do I fall this scale, if you will, of hobbyism? I would call it tourism, in a way, bystanderism, and define what that is and what you're trying to say about it in your book, Politics is for Power.
Well, look, I mean, I think people of all stripes politically can be hobbyists. That just means that they like politics as an idea. They like the idea of political power. They just don't want to actually do it. And in some cases, I think they see it's beneath them. Like, activism is, like, dirty, or, you know, kind of nuts, you know, messy. You know, I have to tell you a little story, which is that I took students to a zoning board meeting, you know, and they had never been to a zoning board meeting. And quickly they realized that there was this woman, maybe about 50 years old, who we learned basically was there every week. She, like, once a week in the evening, she showed up to the zoning board meeting. And she was sort of a lone wolf. And everyone at the meeting knew her. She knew all the rules just by coming week after week. She learned the rules. And there was this kind of funny moment at this meeting where she said her piece. She's kind of an antagonist to the developers. And then one of the developers, who's also a regular there, stood up and said, "I have an announcement to make. You know, I agree with Susan." And the board laughed because, oh, my gosh, the developer agreed with Susan. Okay, so you look at someone like Susan, this person at the zoning board meeting, but I'm not really sure what her name was. Didn't really know. And you think, is this person nuts? I think that's people's first reaction. Like, who would do this? And the answer is, no, she's not nuts. The rest of us sitting at home with our Netflix feed who are not doing a thing, or watching cable news. I mean, this person once a week spends her evenings learning how power works on issues that relate to the environment, to racial equality, to the economy of her community. And even without any other peers there with her, she's accumulated quite a bit of power just because she knows how to work that room. And that, you know, part of my goal in this book is to say, you know, if you think that's crazy, then just so you know, like, you don't really know what's going on in politics, because that's what politics is about. It's getting people, whether they're politicians or your neighbors or the developers or whoever, to do something that they wouldn't otherwise do. And if you're not doing that, you're not doing politics.
Well, of course, you've got a chapter at the end, learning to want power. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about. What about those of us who like to cajole, who like to show how well informed we are, who like to debate and argue, but don't get into the trenches in real policy making areas or politically defining ways where you go out and you knock on the door of a neighbor and you say, "Hey, are you going to get involved in this? Because this is really important and here's where I stand."
Look, you know, what I want to say to those people and is I just want to show you who else is doing this. You know, I talk in the book about the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina going around in the 2018 election saying to opioid addicts, "Hey, this addict's not your fault, and we here at the KKK are here to help you." And they're doing that because, you know, they're not going to gain many supporters by talking about their horrible ideology. But, you know, if they're helping people, offering people a helping hand and no one else is, they might get some members. And so, look, if you're the kind of person who's kind of interested in politics but above the fray and you don't want to dirty your hands, I just want you to know who else is doing it instead of you. And if you're comfortable with that, whether it's the KKK or any political group you don't like, then okay, that's what's going on. You know, I think there's a lot of people, political center or, you know, left center, right center, who look at politics and lament polarization and how could it be that these candidates, whether it's Donald Trump, you don't like him, or Bernie Sanders, you don't like him, why are all the people going to those folks and not to the people I like better? Well, it's because you're sitting on your couch above the fray. That's why. And so, you know, part of it is just saying, like, this is what politics is about. It's about power. It's not about sitting on your couch. But if you want to sit on your couch, then just you should be comfortable with the KKK doing what it's doing and polarized groups all across the country doing what they're doing, because they obviously want power more than you do.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Eitan Hersh. Politics is for power. I'm smiling because you have nailed so many people that I know, and in some ways myself. You say a third of Americans say they spend 2 hours or more each day on politics, yet 4 out of 5 say not 1 minute is spent on any real political work.
That's right. And by the way, you're laughing and I'm laughing too because you know, because you've read the book, that I'm from the hobbyist world. And so I know the excuses as well as anyone. I'm, you know, my own political views are moderate. For my own professional work, just like yours, I'm not in media, but I'm in academia, and I think it's very important to make sure I can analyze issues in a non-partisan way. You know, this, I don't come from a world of political organizing. I had to learn this. And I learned it because I looked at statistics like the one you just mentioned that almost everybody who's spending time on politics, hours, I mean, I'm not talking about people who have such busy lives they can't spend any time on politics. That's not who this book is about. This book is about people who are already spending an hour or two every day thinking, talking, worrying about politics. And they're doing it in this bizarre way. You know, so as a social scientist, I look at the data when it comes to how they're following the news. What news are they following? When are they voting? When are they not voting? How are they involved in activism of any kind? Okay, so they're signing online petitions every once in a while. That's the main form of activism they're doing. And so one behavior after the other, I think it's pretty clear that our collective energy spent on politics is mostly spent on a leisure activity, a hobby. And I think that when I see that, you know, when I see people spending hours of their workday like watching a congressional hearing or something like that, I think, my God, they're wasting so much time, and this time could be better spent.
But what if they are tweeting at the same time? What if they're writing a letter or signing a petition to a congressman feeling, hey, I am really getting engaged, but I'm using new tools that are available to me? I mean, you do talk about the 5 common types of political activity: news consumption, partisan cheerleading, voting, then there's activism, and donating. So what if they're doing a few of those things and feeling rather, well, self-satisfied?
Look, we can paint with broad strokes. Some of these things are obviously, you know, sometimes good and sometimes bad, and there's lots of gray area. But when we do politics in a way that's serving kind of our short-term instant gratification needs, we're doing it badly and we're making things worse. So, you know,
stop on that. That's really interesting. Okay, so somebody who's working 12-day and they just can't get involved, they don't read the newspaper, as opposed to somebody who's reading a newspaper, who's going online and looking at all the aggregator sites, watching the impeachment going on as we speak. I mean, so they're worse than the person who admittedly doesn't have time and is trying to just, you know, put food on the table. Why is it worse?
You know, the way I think about it is if you're spending an hour or two a day on politics, right, you have energy that you can obviously dedicate it to this. You know, how many votes are you getting? You know, you're entitled to your one vote, all right? First of all, are you using that? Are you using it locally? And second of all, how many more can you influence? That's politics, okay? So I talk about in the book, you know, people who say control 1,000 votes, like have precincts where they have two or three times the turnout of all the precincts around them because they have earned the respect of their neighbors. And I say, okay, what are the rest of us doing compared to that? But I also give examples of how some of these short-term instant gratification forms of politics are bad. And I think we can see this, you know, we can see it really clearly, for example, in low-dollar donations, right? So I often present to audiences that are predominantly liberal, and I say, you know, who's the best low-dollar fundraiser? And people say, usually say Bernie Sanders. And then I say, of course, that's wrong. Because it's Donald Trump, right? We know this. Donald Trump is the best at raising money in small dollar donations. And the reason is because the thing that drives small dollar donations is provocation and outrage. It's saying some horrible zinger. It's, you know, It's being angry. It's being dramatic, because that's what we respond to in the moment. It makes us feel good when we get to react. And because of that, politicians know that they need to behave in a way that gets that. And I think, you know, anyone who watches a congressional hearing or a presidential debate, you know you're watching politicians who are trying to make a viral video at every move. And the reason they're doing that is because we have incentivized them to do that.
You say that most people spend their political, quote-unquote, lives satisfying their own emotional and intellectual curiosities rather than trying to influence the community. So, I mean, how, again, self-satisfied does somebody, and basically you define who they are in large part, college-educated, white males, 56% of men you consider to be the political hobbyists in America?
Well, you know, it's just that they're disproportionately found in the group of people who spend a lot of time on politics but no time, you know, engage in any kind of volunteerism. So, yeah, you have this group of people that's highly educated. They politics is part of their social scene. You know, they're supposed to keep up on things. You know, they'll talk about it. And so they follow kind of the big ideas, and they're willing to discuss them. But when you look at groups of folks who are actually in communities organizing, it's overwhelmingly women, and it's disproportionately minorities. And, you know, I think that the most clear explanation for that is that people who are really feel more threatened by the status quo need to get more out of politics than just a parlor game. And, you know, meanwhile, if you love politics but you don't feel immediately threatened by it, then it can be more of a game. And you know, you see that in the data. Men, even through 2016, 2018, you know, they know more facts about politics. They say they're more interested in politics. They say they're spending more time on politics, but they're doing less. That's what the data show.
Well, I think it's fascinating, because I think you're absolutely right that for many years in America, I always looked at politics almost as a parlor game, where one party was a little left of center, one party was a little right of center. Things were going along okay. Changes were occurring that were in a more positive direction. But it's really interesting that if you are more moderate to liberal, you saw the conservatives organizing in so many ways. I did a podcast on the Long Southern Strategy, and you look at the way that the evangelicals in particular have used the pulpit to really motivate and activate and to really make it a political center for so many. And yet those who probably are more liberal or live in the Northeast or whatever don't even believe any longer or aren't going to church, and they're not getting mobilized that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see the best examples of grassroots organizing are on the right, you know, the Right to Life movement, the gun rights movement, whether they're through churches or through gun clubs that are offering, you know, free safety classes for kids and a community. And so folks don't really care about politics, get roped into supporting those issues. And that's a long game that they're playing, and it's played by building community. And I think about examples like Right Life movement saying, hey, and through churches, hey, let's support this 25-year-old kid who just got his law degree. Let's make sure he gets to be a county judge, because they know that in 30 years, that person might be on the Supreme Court. And a lot of people will look at like a county judge race, especially I think among these kind of college educated liberals, and think like, ugh, that's beneath me. You know, I care about the big stuff. I care about the stuff going on Supreme Court and the Senate and the Congress, but you know, I don't want to be bothered with parochial stuff in the county judgeships. So, I mean, it's that kind of short-term thinking that I think is disempowering.
In your book, page 196, I've got to read this. They accuse them of being hobbyists, of participating in politics from their perch of middle-class comfort and failing to come to grips with the true life and death stakes of political power in America. Being white and financially comfortable makes it hard to understand a sense of fear that would push people to want power. Being white and comfortable means already having enough power. Only if you need more power than you already have could politics be for fun. It's when you don't have as much as you need. That's when politics is for power, which is the name of your book.
Yeah, you know, I think people understand this in different contexts than politics, but it's hard, because in politics, real power building feels dirty. Even the word power can make people feel uncomfortable. I've noticed this. I've talked to groups and say, I'm not sure, but that sounds like scary. I'm not sure that's something that I relate to that. You know, I write in the book earlier on about about Howard Schultz. And I write about Howard Schultz. This is the founder of Starbucks.
Of course.
Because Howard Schultz...
And all the hobbyists know his name.
Yeah, but, you know, he had this short-term idea of running as a third-party candidate for president, which a lot of people dismissed as a bad idea, and it was a bad idea. But what's interesting about Howard Schultz is that Starbucks is such a great example of how to build power, of how to build power for a brand, how to get money. Right? I mean, the story is, first of all, grassroots, starting from one store to 15 stores in one region of the country, figuring out what works, figuring out what doesn't work. Starbucks was known for hiring. This is, you know, good salaried people who were going to stay at Starbucks for years. I mean, they were always lauded for kind of paying their staff and giving them more benefits, more incentive to stay on and build those relationships. So these are basically community organizers who are selling a brand with competition and saying, hey, this is better than the alternative, and I'm going to be here every day, and you're going to see me in the store. Starbucks also, of course, incentivized people to come to the store through, you know, free internet. And if they didn't like what you got a free coupon. And even though the original version of that store was kind of snobby with opera music and bow-tied baristas, you know, eventually they started selling those frappuccinos. And, you know, of course, they did what they needed to do to become this massively successful brand. But when it comes to politics, if you take any of those lessons, okay, let's start not with a national TV campaign, but with grassroots. Let's focus on paying organizers who are going to be in this community long term to build relationships. And let's give voters what they want, you know, whether it's a free internet in a Starbucks, you know, they like some policy or they like some idea, or, you know, you have an organizer go around and make sure people are get the help they need paying their bills or getting that turkey on Christmas. And all of a sudden people say, oh, that's kind of dirty machine politics. That's not my interest. I want to keep politics kind of clean and from a distance.
And I want an off-ramp if I don't want to get involved. And I don't think I want to really hang out with these people all the time and be crossing names off of lists. I mean, I'm sure there are just so many reasons that people give. But let me ask you about the time that we're in. You know, I talked about people congealing around the center generally. Well, now we seem to be going to more out toward the extremes in both camps. And we're leaving a lot of room in the center. And there are a lot of people who are unaffiliated. They're independents. Now, you say that they plug into politics in very superficial ways. So they give themselves an off-ramp immediately saying, well, I just don't really buy into the entire agenda on the right or the left. Therefore, I'll just watch these two duke it out, and then I'll go to the polls from time to time and get different. Tell us what's going on here as we move out more toward the extremes, even though we've got two big tent parties.
Well, yeah, so I mean, what's going on in the middle is that there's these two political psychologists, Yana Krubnikov and Samara Klar, who have written about what's going on in the heads of independents. And they have amazing data that basically, you know, independents, people who say, oh, I'm not a Democrat or Republican, they actually generally do have very strong partisan inclinations. Actually, they're pretty ideological. They're as ideological as people who identify as Democrats or Republicans. But they have kind of the worst parts of partisans. That is, and none of the good parts. So they feel these deep ideological ideas, and they get mad when a party or a candidate doesn't do what they think is right. But they're completely unwilling to work for a party, work for a campaign. They say, oh, you know, I'm above that. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. And so then they wonder why, you know, why is partisanship taken over by the extremes? Like, okay, because you're not showing up. And you know, I think the reason is that the parties over time, they've changed and they've become less like community organizations, less like church groups. And the only reason it seems to a lot of people that you would ever be part of a political party or work for a party or candidate is because you're an ideologue. And if the only thing that the parties are offering is ideology, then, you know, and you don't feel that ideological, then you know, why would you go to a local meeting and have to hang out with all these extremists? The answer is that, for one thing, parties don't have to be that way. They don't have to be ideological. They can be, in a way, like a community service organization where they have a mission, which is to help their neighbors and to serve their community. And they can do that in part through service, and they do that in part by passing laws that help that community. And so if you have a vision of political parties that is, we are here to try to make this country and community better, and we're going to do it in concrete ways, then all of a sudden, like, it's not a debate about, you know, big national policy issues like we see now in the Democratic primary that are never going to happen, but that take a lot of emotional energy.
What about the 2018 elections? We hear that there were so many first-time candidates, people who'd never run before. They had different positions in life. They were scientists. They were community organizers of one sort or another. Or they were in the deep state, quote-unquote, and they decided that I've got to run for office. How much of the energy that we've seen on the right has moved the energy again over to the left, where people who might have looked at it as a parlor game say, wait a minute, there's some real issues at stake here?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people on the left or on the center right, people who didn't like President Trump, reacted to 2016 by getting more involved and feeling like, you know, I really have to do more than just be online. And we saw a lot of activism in 2018. The thing that's in the back of my head is this short-termism around this. So a lot of your listeners probably can remember the 2008 election, really high turnout, a lot of engagement, particularly by Democrats. The country wasn't in a good place in terms of the economy. Of course, the Iraq War had been going on for a long time, and people were angry, and they got out to vote in large numbers. And they were committed to this agenda that the Obama campaign was offering. But the second that the 2008 election happened, those people said, okay, our job is done. Turnout dropped precipitously in the next midterm election so that the Obama agenda really didn't have a chance to be implemented. When there was these town hall meetings, vicious town hall meetings about the health care bill, you had all these activated Tea Party folks. Republicans at that time felt their stuff was threatened, their ideas were threatened, so they started showing up, and Democrats just sat home. And they sat home in the 2010 election, and they sat home in the 2014 election, and they largely sat home in the 2016 election. And now, after Trump, they get excited. And meanwhile, by the way, now that Trump's elected, a lot of these Tea Party groups have died off. And even since 2018, I get some communications from some of the activist groups on the left saying, you know, our numbers are way down compared to what they were in 2017 when the energy was high. You know, I think if politics is so short-term oriented, then the second things go wrong, you know, oh, the impeachment trial is not what Democrats hoped it would be, or the Democratic primary didn't turn out the candidate I liked, then you feel, okay, forget about this. I'm tired of this. But if you're embedded in this deep community of political organization, or, by the way, religious organization, any kind of community organization, then you know, the ups and downs are not as important because that's not what's driving you to participation.
Yeah, you even talk about spiritualism and real religious affiliation in the same context. In closing, let me ask you, the book again is called Politics is for Power. What moves somebody from the hobbyist mode into the activist mode? And do you sense that that is going on, or is it this short-term rush to change one thing or another and then retreat back, you know, to watching AC360 every night?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as you know, and as I hope some of your listeners will see, the book is not a bummer. It's not about everything we're doing wrong, because it's a lot of focus of it is on these people who are doing it really well. And they're not like politicians. None of the people in the book are professionals. They're all kind of ordinary citizens who figured out a way to take local leadership seriously. And that's basically what we need. You know, it's people who are potential leaders or who already are leaders, bringing more people on board with them, and people saying, you know, I'm willing to be out of my house one night a week. I'm willing to be in an organization. I'm willing to have some false starts. You know, all these people had false starts. You know, they tried to find a way to participate and it didn't work out. And so they tried another way, and they tried another way. And then they've created in the process these robust communities that are resilient to the ups and downs of the moment. And so I think a lot of people out there have real leadership potential to influence their neighborhoods and their communities, and they can't be wasting it on the couch anymore.
Well, it's interesting. A woman who critiqued your book, I saw online, Wendy Willis, and she quoted John Updike. She said, hobbies take place in the cellar and smell of airplane glue. And then she also quoted this wrong-headed trickster, the name of Edward Abbey, saying, saving the world is only a hobby. Most of the time I do nothing. Well, I'll leave it at that. Eitan Hersh, fascinating conversation. Politics is for power. How to move beyond political hobbyism, take action, and make real change. I thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks for having me.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofits.